Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars.
Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 22 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods, who's on Vancouver Island. And Tim, tell us about today's topic.
Well, Steve, we've got more than one topic today. And well, that's because this episode is actually the finale for Season 2. So we are first going to take a look at China's space program, which has certainly been in the news this year. And then after the break, we're going to go back over the ground we've covered in Season 2. But first, as always, we've got a couple of updates. And Steve, why don't you start us off?
Well, in this season finale, Tim, I've got two updates which in general reflect my concern of mainstream reporting of science. Now, for starters, I read just this week that particle physicists are a step closer to unraveling how to measure gravity at the quantum level. Using a new technique employing levitating magnets, physicists at England's University of Southampton have successfully detected a weak gravitational pull created by a subatomic particle. Now, we should note that Einstein was baffled by quantum gravity and, in his theory of general relativity, said there was no realistic experiment that could show a quantum version of gravity. Well, 115 years later, this no longer seems to be the case. My concern about this article is how it's going to be reported to the general public. I mean, I had to scour many sources to find it. Will it appear on the TV jam between details of Mrs. Murphy's chickens running amok on rural Route 3? Only time will tell. My second update is one I'm almost ashamed to announce because the news of this broke in October 2023, but I just read of it. And why did I accidentally find out about it? Why wasn't it more mainstream?
Well, you've got my curiosity aroused, Steve. Whatever was it?
Well, Tim, it seems our moon is 40 million years older than previously thought, thanks in part to not only Apollo 17, the last mission to the moon in 1972, but also Western University in London, Ontario. A study of moon rock was led by Dr. Audrey Bouvier, a cosmochemist. And you know, cosmochemist is a new one on me, Tim.
Let me guess, Steve. A cosmochemist studies the chemical composition of extraterrestrial objects and matter?
A new study published in Geochemical Perspectives Letters, what a mouthful, outlined an advanced analysis of crystals from a moon rock called 72255. And yes, that's really its name. They estimated the moon was 40 million years older than previously thought, and last October this was confirmed. So hats off to Western University.
Yeah, that is surprising that something of that sort, that import, would not make mainstream news. So by the way, Steve, I understand that the title of this paper, Confirmation, is a bit of a doozy. And can you imagine reading something that's called Radiogenic Lead Mobilization Induced by Shock Metamorphism?
I couldn't even pronounce that. Well done. Now, let's hear your update, Tim.
Well, this is a lot more in the news and not hard to find on social media. I just wanted to, of course, mention that we started talking about Starship's first effort to launch back late last year, and they failed. It blew up. They did it again not long after the first try. And well, the day I'm speaking and recording this, they had try number three, which I'm sure most people would have paid attention to. What I wanted to say, though, Steve, is if you dig a little deeper behind those mainstream stories, you can find some really interesting descriptions of the many changes that were made between the second attempt and the third, and really quite impressive that they could change so many things in such a short space of time and carry out some new experiments. I'm going to just mention one. It's pivotal that this spacecraft be able to get refueled when it's in orbit. Now, this is an entirely new concept. All they could experiment with on their short flight today was to move fuel from one part of the interior of the spacecraft to another, and they did that successfully. May sound like small potatoes, but it's one of the biggest challenges they're going to have to face. So I think that is an update, and a major change in where we're at in this whole mission of flying further into space.
Thanks for that, Tim. You know, it seems like we've been wanting to talk about the Chinese space program for ages, and it's really surprising how much the Chinese have accomplished and how much has been flying under the radar, shall we say. And again, we're talking about the media coverage of science in general and space in particular. And here's an example of that, Tim. A few weeks ago, North American media, both American and Canadian, went into swarm mode in the coverage of the US return to the lunar surface by the private company Intuitive Machines. Given the fact that the Japanese landed a similar mission 2 months prior to that, and India succeeded in landing a spacecraft near the South Pole just last summer, and the most impressive landing since the Apollo program, which didn't involve the Russians or India, and that distinction would go to China. And we should hasten to note that the Chinese spacecraft dubbed Chang-3 landed successfully on the moon all the way back in 2013. And let us not forget that the Chinese like to play the long game when it comes to foreign policy. For example, way back on November 18, 1957, Mao Zedong addressed the Communist Workers' Party saying, "What it all boils down to is that we must strive for 15 years of peace. Then, after that, we'll be invincible. Nobody will dare to fight us."
And that was 67 years ago. But we're going to fast forward, if you will, to the Chinese manned space program. Now, they call their space crew taikonauts, which means space travelers. And as of last fall, well, they had 20 of them. And like the Americans and Russians, the Chinese have gotten into the space station business, launching the first module, Tiangong, in April of 2021. And by the way, that's a lovely name given. Tiangong means heavenly palace or celestial palace in Chinese. And that is certainly more romantic than ISS. The Chinese space station is about one-third the size of the International Space Station, and it's been permanently staffed since June 2022. The only non-Chinese visitor to Tiangong was Hollywood megastar Sandra Bullock, and that was in her fictional visit during the classic movie Gravity. But stay tuned, Steve. The Chinese started training foreign-born taikonauts last year, and they've repeatedly made assurances that there will be an international flavor to their space station, just as we've seen for so long with the ISS.
Well, that international intent may be somewhat encouraging, but we've got fresh information on where the Chinese space program is going, and it's not quite friendly.
This less friendly news is going to make listeners think of none other than Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Well, we can be lighthearted about this, but some of the news we've got to share on this episode is in fact worrying. My issues with the Chinese space program has to do with the rocket propellants which they use to get their spacecraft into orbit. You can literally see where my concern is by going online and watching the launch of a Chinese rocket. The distinguishing feature is the brown scarlet colored plume of smoke, indicating the first stage is using hypergolic fuels. We previously mentioned that hypergolic propellants ignite spontaneously when they come in contact with each other. And though this reactivity makes them suitable for reliable ignition in rocket engines, they come with extremely serious biohazard risks.
You know, I've had people say to me, well, just how serious can that be? I mean, you know, we've all seen American rockets blowing up, even SpaceX's recent Starship, they've blown up a few. What's the big deal, Steve?
Well, the Chinese Long March 1 rockets use unsymmetrical dimethylhydrazine, or UDMH for short, in combination with nitric acid. And that alone sounds scary.
Steve, you don't expect listeners to remember something like unsymmetrical dimethylhydrazine and nitric acid. There's got to be a better name for that.
And you'd be right, Tim. Those compounds are so toxic and dangerous that when the Soviets used it, they called it the devil's venom, and for good reason. The Russians were using it as an ICBM fuel, and on October 24, 1960, a missile on the launch pad suddenly exploded, killing more than 54 people and injuring hundreds more, becoming the deadliest disaster in space exploration history.
It is kind of remarkable and outrageous. And the Chinese space program has continued to use it. And any fallout from these rocket launches in China It also has to be cleaned up. And who do they pick? Villagers. The rocket boosters attached to these rockets land below the trajectory, spewing toxic fumes as they fall back to Earth. And then the villagers are put under extreme political pressure to sweep up the debris. This is all available online, Steve. Even by Chinese official media sources, they admit to typically evacuating populations in advance of some of these launches. The China news agency admitted that just one launch generated the evacuation of 100,000 people, and another 2,000 were recruited to be heroically sent to clean up the mess.
Well, before we go too far in pointing fingers, we should recall that the U.S. Air Force used the same hypergolic propellants on their Titan ICBMs, and it was used in the Apollo programs for the engines on the Command Service Module and Lunar Module. And further, the French use it on their Ariane rockets.
But what about Elon Musk and his SpaceX Raptor engines? Don't tell me they're using the devil's venom.
Not a chance. The Raptor engines use liquid oxygen and methane, and the byproduct of that is carbon dioxide and water.
So let's see where this Chinese prowess in rocketry is getting us in terms of threats to peace. Steve, I want you to go back to 2007 and what was called the ASAT launch, or anti-satellite technology, that was deployed by the Chinese.
The Chinese decided to destroy one of their own defunct weather satellites with a ballistic missile, and the ensuing explosion created the largest ever debris field in space, with more than 3,000 trackable pieces. And more than 15 years later, the International Space Station was forced to maneuver to avoid some of that debris. The concept of disabling satellites, particularly military ones, is cause for alarm. As noted by General Chance Schwartzman, head of the U.S. Space Force, a centerpiece of U.S. strategy is to deter China from taking aim at the Pentagon's most valuable geostationary satellites, which are critical for communications and early warnings of missile launches. The fixed positions of these geosynchronous satellites makes them particularly vulnerable to direct attack, and to offset that weakness, the Space Force plans to augment geostationary systems with networks of satellites in low and medium orbits.
So space debris, we were talking about that recently on our show, but we were at the time talking about the debris of actual satellites. Now what we're talking about is what would happen in regards to a few intentional explosions designed to cause enormous ripple effects. Okay, enough. Time to catch up with the very latest in news about the Chinese space program. And frankly, I thought the capper to this focus was going to be on a really special lunar landing that's coming up, Chang 5, that will be landing on the moon this year. It's going to be digging up some lunar rocks and returning them to Earth. And that's a mission far more ambitious than anything the United States has planned for its lunar program in the next few years. However, our news today is about the expansion of a terrestrial spy program currently operating in China by the Chinese. It's being expanded to focus on what's happening in space, and in particular, what will be happening on the surface of the moon in a very short period of time. And the name of this program, Steve, Skynet. Well, that's right, Skynet.
And if that doesn't send shivers up and down your spine, nothing will. And if you've seen the Terminator series, you'll know what we mean. In the movie, Skynet was a fictional artificial intelligence designed to protect NORAD. But as it gained self-awareness, it determined that all humans were evil and must be destroyed. And now you tell me there is something called Skynet?
Well, yes and no. It's the name that we've been given for the Chinese network of recording cameras that exists and are in operation in China that form a security network comprising, listen to this, 600 million cameras, or about one camera for every two citizens. It is the world's largest video surveillance network, and it's officially called Tianwen, which translates as Heavenly King. Skynet 2.0, on the other hand, is the name that's been given to the plans China has announced for a similar security system for what goes on up there on the lunar surface.
Well, first of all, on behalf of our listeners, allow me to say, Tim, you've got to be kidding about this stuff.
You know, I'm not. The published proposal suggests that the lunar-based cameras would automatically link up, providing seamless coverage of their research station located near the South Pole. And here's a little sidebar, Steve. Anybody that's serious about a lunar research station is thinking about the South Pole, because that's the one location on the moon that seems sure to have water in the form of ice found at the depths of some of the deepest craters that have never ever seen daylight. So these tiny lunar cameras the Chinese have in mind would capture both distant and wide-angle views and operate independently in the event of lost communication with the Earth. That in the event of any, quote, abnormalities, the alarm signals will be sent. Now, just what the response measures that would be or what they have in mind, we just don't know.
And I understand that the forthcoming Chinese Lunar Research Station is planned to be quite enormous in size, perhaps with a diameter of 12 kilometers, which for comparative purposes is about the area that would encompass all of Salmon Arm and stretch to the nearby town of Enderby. How is international space law going to be policed and adjudicated when we know how difficult that is to do on Earth?
Both NASA and its Western allies are also planning a lunar research station, and private companies are gearing up to make money, profit opportunities on the moon. And China doesn't want to get left out of the action. So what we're talking about here is a kind of lunar gold rush. And to make matters a little more exciting, the reality is that we believe there isn't that much water to be found all over the moon. It's believed to be in a very narrow area at the lunar south pole. So given that there's going to be some huge investments necessary to have any chance of turning a profit, everyone's focus will be narrowing in on that one small corner of the moon. And then, of course, then security becomes a genuine concern.
And to underline their intention to play it for keeps, in December 2022, China announced a strategic plan to become a strong space nation by 2030. And then 15 years later, by 2045, it plans to become a comprehensive space power.
And we thought this would be a great time to review our second season of the show. And actually, it's not a bad time to pull the curtain back just a wee bit, talk about how we do the show and reveal all of our secrets. Steve, we started the season with something of a bit of a change for us. We were recording the first few episodes in the CKVS studio just as the renovations were winding up. And when I had a chance to come over to Salmon Arm from my home in Vancouver Island and join you. And I just wondered, Steve, if you'd comment on what you found that to be useful or what?
Well, I did, Tim, because when we're sitting facing one another, separated by just a few feet or so, and we both had the headsets on and we can look at each other and pick up on nuances visually, you point a finger at the other guy and you go, yeah, you're on right now. So that's really quite beneficial. And if you want to change something up, it's very easy to do right then and there. So those are some of my observations, Tim. I found that it was easier for us to, as I say, communicate and get started. Whereas if you and I tried to do our Zoom meetings using the visual aspect as well, we start using up too much bandwidth. So how did you feel about recording live in the studio, Tim?
You know, I think energy was one of the big differences I found that, you know, you and I have a shared interest in this, and put the two of us in the same small space of the actual radio studio. And I don't know, I've just felt kind of energized by that. You know, I could see your interest. It was real right in front of me. And the sound, you know, the sound quality that we were able to achieve with the professional equipment, you just can't say enough, I guess, about the benefits of, you know, being in the same place. I think I probably picked up on this from listening to even things like CBC when there's a host, you know, say in Toronto and they're interviewing a guest in Newfoundland or something. Somehow it doesn't necessarily carry the same impact or really being in the moment. So I thought that was good. And another thing that I wanted to reveal the truth about here is music. We both really enjoy music. You've done a whole series of shows. We couldn't really use music in this show. And I was wondering if you could explain the problem. It relates to podcasts, does it not?
Each of our episodes requires a log. And on the log, you have to put down the date of the airings, the number of volunteer hours that were put in. If you do have an intro and an outro music, as we do, who's performing it? What is the length of that? And then for the balance of our speaking, that's counted as spoken words. And we have to split it up into half, as most people know, with the station break. So you have to do a compilation of the time in the first half and the time in the second half, subtract the length of the time for any music that you may put in. And CKVS has a mandate to produce a certain number of hours of spoken word per week. And if you do put in music, the composer and the artist are noted and the duration of time, and so they can get royalties. However, you can't include the music in a podcast because there's no way of knowing how many times a listener will tune in to a particular piece of music. Royalties can't be granted. Therefore, there's no music in the podcast. So when we do our podcast, I have to delete a little bit about we're going to be right back after the station break and run the whole thing together. And if there is any music, we have to, perhaps you can refer to it, but you can't actually play it.
Well, it's a shame, Steve, but it is what it is. It means that we're stuck talking to each other for a full half an hour unless we find some fun snippets to throw in. And you do quite often. I have myself as well, but trying to get the show to be a bit more dynamic and finding some interesting bits of information that don't come out of either your mouth or mine. We've had to do quite a bit more research to track down good content, good research. And I was wondering if you could tell us about the fun that we're both having doing that research and how you go about it.
Well, sometimes when you're writing the script, and listeners, we do have to run a script here because when Tim and I just try to wing it, it doesn't come out as well as it could be. Although if you were in a pub or a coffee bar, it would sound pretty good. But when you listen to it with a critical ear, you realize, oh no, there's a lot of ums and ers and ahs, and the sequence didn't flow so well. So we work off a script. And in the process of creating that script, ideas pop into your mind. You say, oh, that reminds me of a Space Ranger TV show I remember. And then you scoot off to the YouTube and try to hunt it down. And you can, if it's there, then perhaps you can get a sound bite off of it. So those are kind of some interesting things. And as a matter of fact, the Sputnik sound that we hear at the trailing edge of each episode of Space Talks is the actual Sputnik 1 space sound. And that was surprisingly hard to find.
It's been fun doing that. And I know I was tracking down Chris Hatfield online, and geez, that man has an empire of great material. And there's videos, instructional information about his time in space. He's written books. He's written fictional books. And there's just some mind-bending topics you can find online when you think you're going down a fairly predictable route to track down some basic information, and all of a sudden you come across things that are so much out of the familiar. Now, I wanted to address the feature of the show we've been using for 2 years. We call them updates. And, you know, I don't know that we really expected that there would always be much new going on in space news. And just in the 2 years we've been doing the show, Steve, I just think you'd have to agree. It's changed dramatically, I think. My goodness, I just wanted to read you a list of some news that had been in my purview in the last 7 days. There was the SpaceX launch of the Starship that happened, which is pretty important. There's stories about the upcoming solar eclipse and how United Airlines is having to put on special flights for people who want to be up in the air for that phenomenon to see it. The Outer Space Treaty, we mentioned it in today's show. It's more than 50 years old. It's popping up in the news all over the place. We heard about Russia's plans to put a nuclear-powered entity on the moon. Well, people started wondering about the legality of that. Every week, the James Webb Telescope is releasing new images, and they're incredible. You can talk about those all day. And finally, look at these lunar landers. It's like whack-a-mole up there on the moon. Sure, some of them are crashing, but this is incredible the way things are developing as fast as they are. And every week we could just have the show be current news, don't you think?
As I think we mentioned on one particular part, we didn't know if we would have enough material. And now we have to actually sift through it and say, no, there's so much. What are we going to do? What can we possibly do this week? That's the most important. It's certainly changed from the 1970s and the 1980s, even with regard to the number of satellites that are being launched. I was just in researching today, Rocket Launch Live. Believe it or not, you go to Rocket Launch Live. There's a Starlink. I think there are six different Starlink launches in this coming week, and they're putting up something like 80 satellites alone. Well, back when we were youngsters and young men, there might be one satellite launch in a week.
At the most,
Something.
at the
I
most.
know.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it just it's just it makes it fun for us, and it makes, I mean, the potential for what we could do or to be finding that's of interest. And that's a nice segue to what we hope to consider for season three. And we would like to do some, I don't know, polling. We'd like to find out what might be, what kinds of topics and areas of exploration would be of interest to people. And I know I've got Steve and I have mentioned before, there's so many great Canadians who've made huge marks on astronomy and space-related matters. We'd like to track down some of these people and get them on our show and see if they can share some of their wisdom and insights and experience with us. I think that would be fun. Steve, you've got some other topics that you've been kicking around. Why don't you share that?
Along that line, Tim, I was thinking that even if we can't actually get a Canadian scientist or only one or two, we could start doing a little spotlight on Canadian scientists in their various fields, throw them in each episode, and sort of like fishing. Once you know where the good spots are in the pond. So once you start going to websites such as Science Tech Daily, Space News, Live Science, Fermilab, the list of Canadians that pop up here and there are just outstanding.
This current season, we've been talking about dark matter and, you know, acronyms of places and names of organizations and entities that are just beyond just about anybody's reach. So it's finding the sweet spot in between. I've enjoyed the series that we've started on the individual planets. It's made me think that we might do similar series. One idea that crossed my path was a look at the way our weather is impacted by space, whether it's our own atmosphere, the moon, the sun. There's probably all kinds of interesting information that we could track down, and everyone's interested in the weather, but no one ever does anything about it except us here on Space Talks. You know, Steve, I think that's all the time we have for this episode, and in fact, for this season two of Space Talks. So here on Vancouver Island, it's Tim Woods.
This is Stephen Lowry and Salmon Arm with a little quote from Michael Collins, who was on the first lunar trip to land people on the moon. And he said, "It's human nature to stretch, to go, to see, to understand. Exploration is not a choice, really, it's an imperative."
We'll see you next time on Space
Space
Talks.
Talks.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring.